It is May 29th. Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman, Errant Cherry.
Yes.
On the show today, we're going to start at the end of this segment by discussing what exactly is going on with the freshman senator from Pennsylvania. Talking about John Fetterman, once considered a progressive darling, has broken with the left wing of the party on several key issues, immigration, but perhaps most notably, the war in Gaza. We'll talk with Annie Carney from the New York Times about Fetterman's trajectory. After that, the big segment today, the middle segment, is about social networks and longevity.
Yes, friendships.
Does having more friendships, larger social networks, contribute to having a longer and healthier life? Apparently, scientists have concluded this. I also concluded it by watching The Golden Girls.
Yes.
but apparently, scientists did a lot of studies in addition to my viewing of The Golden Girls, and they have concluded that, yes, indeed, it does. So we're going to dive into that whole topic because I am curious what the connection between these two things is.
Yeah, and we need to be starting now. We did a whole show on how to make adult friendships. Because you got to shore, you got to shore up those friendships,
oh, right?
We did
do that.
Yeah, and people really liked it. And a lot of folks have trouble making those connections.
Right,
so
we'll talk
with someone today who has made those connections, has built community. What does that look like? Mm-hmm. And how it helps with your well-being. So looking forward to that conversation.
End of the show today, we're going to do another type of generational deep dive. But this is on the other end of the age spectrum. We're going to hear from some folks in Gen Z, some Zoomers. About what they
Zoomers. I love that title. Yes.
Oh, I think that's pretty.
I have not heard that.
Is that not common? Zoomers?
Boomers and Zoomers. Go ahead.
I think the producers think it's pretty common. Yeah, Zoomers. Yeah, they're Zoomers. They call them Zoomers. Mm-hmm. Gen Z.
I love it. Look, I learn something new every day. I did not know. So go ahead.
I'm delighted by your delight. Okay. Zoomers. We're going to hear from a trio of them about how they view the other generations and not necessarily the differences that they feel, but some of the similarities and the kinship they feel with folks in older generations.
Yeah, it's a delightful, thoughtful conversation. And we want to hear from you about friendships. If you want to add anything about, you know, something you've learned from maybe a Zoomer, if you're a Boomer or you're, you know, all of that, you can call us 888-477-9499.
I'm going to be embarrassed if this is
not
a commonly used
word. Email studio2@whyy.org. Do you have friends? How important are friendships to your well-being?
Are you a Zoomer?
Or a Boomer.
Give us a call.
Or a millennial.
888-477-9499. Okay, Cherry, let's do some news headlines before we get to all that. And I'm going to give you the shovel.
Oh, we're digging into the
we're
news.
Digging in.
I love it. So remember Ørsted. It's that global renewable energy giant that was supposed to build wind farms off the coast of New Jersey, and then they pulled out of the deal. Well, they have settled with the Garden State, Avi. Ørsted will pay New Jersey $125 million, nearly half of the $300 million that it originally promised to pay if it was unable to build those contracted wind farms. Governor Murphy says that New Jersey will use that money to invest in other projects, including manufacturing and clean energy. And while the $125 million was less than the $300 million, it is a down payment on continuing the effort to expand New Jersey's offshore wind supply. So this is has been a big part of the Murphy administration. You know, Murphy wanted to achieve 11 gigawatts of renewable energy by 2040, enough to power millions of homes in the Garden State.
Yeah, but the clock is ticking on
the
that.
Clock,
and
TikTok.
Ørsted pulling out of its two planned projects is a huge blow. It's interesting that for whatever reason, Ørsted was able to convincingly argue to New Jersey that they did not have to pay the full $300 million. Best I could tell, it has something to do with some bureaucratic wrangling with the Board of Public Utilities and what they did and didn't do to codify that arrangement. So they end up just paying $125. It's less than half, as you mentioned. But I guess some money is better than no money, but this is still a huge setback.
Yeah, a huge setback. And of course, they have four projects totally approved in the state of New Jersey. Governor Murphy wants a fifth one approved, but you still need people to do the work. So, you know, we'll be watching this story as New Jersey tries to continue its move toward clean energy.
Across the river now to Delaware, where the legislature is working on a series of bills aimed at protecting fertility treatment, abortion access, and overall reproductive rights. So three bills. The one that's furthest along would codify legal protections for fertility treatment providers, you know, IVF and the like. The second bill, which is out of committee, would create new requirements around reporting for crisis pregnancy centers, which many advocates of abortion see as purveyors of misinformation on this issue. And then the third bill, which is also out of committee, would require Delaware's public universities to provide access to medication for the termination of pregnancy and emergency contraception. More colloquially, we might call those abortion pills, right? Yeah. Or medical abortion. So that's already legal in the state of Delaware, but this would require the University of Delaware and Delaware State to provide access to that form of medical treatment. So three bills, all on this topic, all moving. We'll see how far each of them get.
Yeah, I mean, lawmakers, of course, were prompted to step up after Roe versus Wade was overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. And then states started, you know, putting in abortion restrictions and bans and trying to punish women who sought treatment for abortion in other states. So they want to sort of codify reproductive health rights here in the first state. Also, the bills, I want to say they are getting some pushback. The one that would deal with pregnancy centers, advocates are arguing that it's likely unconstitutional because it's seeking to silence those providers. But we'll see what happens there. Also, the universities want some clarification off, you know, as to what they have to provide, the standard of care, also liability, because it could have some insurance implications. So a lot of things to be hammered out there.
And Delaware politically is probably not at risk of becoming a state where Republicans control both chambers and the governorship and could pass sweeping restrictions on abortion. However, you never know. States evolve politically, demographics change. And I think the thought is by codifying some things now, you would ensure some protections into the future, regardless of what those changes might be. But this is not like one of those things where if it doesn't get done this session, then A, B, and C could happen in 2 years, 4 years. That would be very unlikely in a state like Delaware.
Yeah. And moving on to our third story in our roundup today. He's a hilarious writer and friend of Studio 2. R. Eric Thomas is now slated to take over the very popular newspaper column, Ask Amy. I don't know if you've ever...
I'm asking Cherry. What's that?
Yeah. Well, Ask Amy is a column that runs in about 150 papers with about 22 million readers.
It's an advice column.
Yeah. The Tribune Content Agency runs the column. And yeah, it's an advice column. It runs in newspapers and you could probably catch it online. After more than two decades, Amy Dickinson, who will step down, she's run that Ask Amy column for many years. And now R. Eric Thomas will have an Ask Eric column.
And he's not, what you should say, he's not just a friend of the show. He's a Philly guy. So
yeah.
One of the biggest dispensers of newspaper column advice in the whole country is going to have a Philly perspective on that advice.
Exactly.
Which is crucial.
And he's written a lot of books. He's also done advice columns in the past. And one of the things that I loved about, he did a Q&A with the Philadelphia Inquirer where he says, this is what makes him qualified. He's both curious and nosy. And he is not, after years of therapy, he's not into telling people exactly what to do. Instead, he says, quote, what I'm trying to become an expert at is being a person who doesn't always know what to do.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. And that is who is writing this column. So that's what he said. So you
maybe we could have R. Eric Thomas
back
on the show.
He was great on the show.
He was great. Yeah. And maybe you could give some of our listeners some advice.
Yeah, and we had him talk about his memoir, Congratulations, The Best Is Over. So that title alone tells you a little bit about his personality, I think.
Would you write an advice column?
Probably not.
That would scare
me. That would be, because you don't know what they're going to ask you about.
Well, and you don't know what they're going to do with the advice. That would just, I would feel the weight of that to be too much.
Yeah,
I'm too anxious to do that.
It's a lot. And when he briefly wrote the Dear Prudence advice column, he had to respond to letters. And this is the title. Help. I can't believe my husband is just letting himself go bald. That is the question. That is the title to a letter.
I can give advice on that. That one I feel okay with. There are some that are heavier than that. I don't know.
But I'm just saying that, you know, it could be very much heavier. But you know, that's our Eric Thomas. Congratulations, and we hope to have you back on Studio 2.
Moving now to our newsmaker interview. Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman has rankled progressive Democrats lately. One of the chief sources of friction is his unconditional support for Israel. Here he is this morning on MSNBC's Morning Joe, responding to a question on the topic.
It's not so much that I'm a supporter of Netanyahu. I follow Israel on that. And that is their democratically elected leader. And that's our key ally. So I'm going to support Israel in that. But to anybody that might be in that situation, it's like, I'm going to lean in on democracy on that situation. I'll absolutely trust and work with somebody like Netanyahu before I would work with Hamas or some of the other places in plague there as well, too.
And all of this is causing consternation among some of his voters and Democratic colleagues. Here to talk more about Fetterman's politics and what some of his party members see as a shift to the right is New York Times congressional correspondent Annie Carney. Welcome to Studio 2, Annie.
Thank you so much for having me.
Annie, can you give us an overview of some of the main areas where Fetterman has broken with the left wing of the Democratic Party?
Yeah, I mean, so the break with Israel is really the major one that has completed a shift that's been happening for a while, but it's not the only one. He has come out for strong border security measures and had and been somewhat more conservative about immigration. He has broken in the past, actually, even before he got to the Senate, with environmentalists on the issue of fracking in Pennsylvania, which is a big issue in his state. He had once said that he would never support fracking, and then he did support fracking in the 2022 election cycle. So he's been trying to ride that line between being environmentally friendly and supporting jobs in his state. But Israel is this unconditional support for Israel that he staked out in the days after the October 7th terrorist attack. As the humanitarian crisis in Gaza has gotten worse, and as this issue has really divided the Democratic Party here, he has placed himself as one of the most vocal supporters of Israel. And like you just heard in that Morning Joe clip, it's just this unconditional, whatever Israel does, I am for, without really ever taking into account that Netanyahu's leadership is driving away public support from Israel worldwide. He doesn't really contend with any of the complicated issues here. He just says, I'm for Israel. And he has taken a very provocative stance. He's put himself in front of this issue. He's waved Israeli flags in the face of protesters. So this is the issue that has really solidified his rift with the left.
And so, Annie, got to ask you, is this shocking? And I want you to take us back a couple of years. Who did Fetterman sell himself to be to Pennsylvania voters? Remind us.
Yeah, it is pretty shocking. He ran as a progressive, although he was always kind of had a complicated relationship with the left. He was not like just an AOC, just like a hardcore progressive. He always called himself a staunch supporter of Israel, but he courted the left. He sold himself as someone who had supported Bernie Sanders in 2016, and the left embraced him as this sort of guy who could speak to working class voters in Pennsylvania, but who was a champion of progressive issue, domestic issues. And he still is on some of them, but he courted the left, but he always challenged their kind of ideological purity tests. And they've always been a little bit confused by him. Again, like I said, the issue of fracking was already something that he split with the left on during that campaign. But his persona across the country was that this is a progressive coming to the Senate. And so it has been shocking. Just not only the position itself, but the kind of aggressive way he's choosing to.
The communication style.
The style has been kind of a shock.
I want to ask about that, though, Annie. Sorry to cut you off, but is it a shock? Because you talked about flag waving, and I remember when he was lieutenant governor here in Pennsylvania, he would hang flags that were sort of meant to trigger conservatives, yes. whether it was like yes. a marijuana leaf flag or
yes.
a rainbow pride flag, and he would hang them from his office window. So it, in yes. some ways, it does seem consistent. It's just that yes. the issues highlighted are different now.
Exactly. So like, yeah, the stylistically, he's always been sort of a, he likes to loudly and kind of sometimes obnoxiously make his point. Like, yeah. yes, he used to fly those flags because Republicans legislators said you can't fly unauthorized flags. So he did. So this is kind of the same guy who likes to like a little trolly like yeah. that. That's kind of his political brand. But he is taking aim at the left instead now. And, you know, the opening scene of the article I wrote was him being approached by an environmental protester in the halls of Congress, and it was caught on video. She was perfectly polite. It was like she asked him about a local pipeline in her community in Chester County. She was a constituent, and he started filming her and making fun of her. It was like a purposefully taking aim yeah. at kind of the wing of the party that he once courted, even if it was always a complicated relationship and he was never totally in line with them. It's the tactics are the same. The who he's targeting has shifted.
And so Annie, got to ask you this. I mean, what is behind this? Could it be politics? Could he just be doing this because of the political atmosphere, or is it something more?
I think there's a lot going on. First of all, I think just like he's a stubborn guy by nature. He staked out this position that after October 7th, and he's not a guy like I think he gets attacked. Like I think it, you know, he doubles, like he grinds in, right? He's not going to change because of people are mad at him. His poll numbers in Pennsylvania are actually going up since October 7th, since he took this Israel stance. So it's not stupid politically. Like he may be part of it, I think, is just his personality, and he's a little bit of a contrarian. And part of it, I think, is like he is looking for a lane that might be more long-term winnable for Democrats.
Quick follow-up. Also, his team has changed. How is that yes. impacting?
Well, he's lost some top advisors who have been with him like basically his whole rise. Some of the people who got him to the Senate are no longer with him. And there's various reasons for that. It's not all like they quit because they disagree with him. But it's notable that the people who got him where he is today are no longer with him. These are people he relied on for political advice. So, you know, he has to replace that team. Some of these trusted voices who could tell him what they really think aren't there anymore. He might be like, you know, politicians yeah. without their most trusted aides might act differently. You might be seeing more stuff that would have been prevented in the past. I don't know.
We let you go, Annie, you mentioned that his poll numbers are up, but at the same time, you need the committed folks to run a campaign, to knock on doors. Is he risking a different type of political blowback by trolling and mocking the left wing of the party? These might be the folks who would volunteer their time and their money to help him get reelected.
Yeah, they might. I mean, what he's doing is he will be building a different coalition. Mm. So he might be relying on different people to be knocking on those doors. And he might end up being more popular than ever, but it will be a different coalition of voters that gets him there.
Well, yeah. That's Annie Carney, congressional correspondent for The New York Times, recently wrote about U.S. Senator John Fetterman from Pennsylvania. Annie Carney, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you. Take care.
And coming up, we talk about the power of friendships as we age. Join the conversation. The number is 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Funded by the Knight Foundation, the Chamber announces its Leading the Way Cell and Gene Therapy in Greater Philadelphia report. More at chmbr.biz/CGTPHL.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manirin.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Avi, we spend so much money and time and energy working on our health, our fitness, trying to stay youthful and to live longer. But there is one thing that money just cannot buy, and that is friendships. And study after study suggests that having a reliable network of people who care for you deeply contributes to longevity.
And there's a logic to it, right? Like-minded people get you out of the house. They keep mm-hmm. you active. They could even be a resource for medical advice. So let's talk about friendship and health. Our first guest is Dr. Michael Daniel Levitch, a doctor at Jefferson Health, specializing in geriatric medicine. Welcome to the program, Dr. Daniel Levitch.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us is Mary Gross. She is a resident of the John C. Anderson Apartments right here in Philadelphia. That's the nation's first LGBTQ senior housing project. Mary, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And listeners, we want to know, how do friendships and social networks contribute to your well-being? Do you live with your friends? Are you taking care of an older family member? What does friendship and community mean to you? You can call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
All right, Dr. Daniel Levitch, I want to start with you. Give us an overview of the research on friendship and health and longevity. What's the connection between all of these?
So the connection is durable and complex. We know that social connections are extremely important for older adults. And we also know that some of the normal aspects of aging, some of the illnesses that can accumulate, sometimes even physical frailty, can make those connections more difficult.
We also, so it's kind of going both ways there?
I would say it's going both ways.
Okay.
I would say that. Societal changes can sometimes make these connections more difficult as people move further away from family. But as someone who works with communities that may be marginalized, especially my interest is LGBTQIA+ health, we know that chosen family, that networks of caregiving and support are especially important for folks to stave off social isolation. As we think about these topics of friendship and connections and health, I like to think about both isolation as well as loneliness as concepts. You know, they're related, but they are different.
How are they different?
Yeah.
So one can be isolated. It is possible to be alone and to be perfectly content with that. Some folks are introverts and really don't need those big networks. It's really loneliness is this idea of distress, of feeling alone, being alone. It's possible to be alone when being surrounded by other people. That's definitely an aspect of reality. But we in geriatric medicine are trying to put more attention on how much that impacts people, to the point where we're actually screening for this in my clinic visits, just like we screen for things like depression or anxiety or high blood pressure or diabetes. We are screening people for social connections and asking them, do you have social connections that give you joy? Do you feel lonely on a daily or weekly or monthly basis? Because we know that health impacts come from this, physical health. And some of those connections are still being explored. We know that people who have strong connections to others are less likely to have conditions like depression or anxiety, and even less likely to develop dementia or heart disease. So it's one of those things that's very difficult in some ways to study, whether it's, is it inflammation? Is it epigenetics, environment mixing with background?
Yeah, like what's the biological link?
And that's the question that I think our field and medicine is really trying to figure out and learning more about. We have some of that data, but certainly not all of it.
And I want to flip the coin a bit because you talked about you asked these questions in your visits with your patients, and sort of what's the flip side? What are some of the signs or red flags that isolation is occurring?
I think when I hear folks who tell me that they're spending a lot of time in the house, who aren't going out, some of the basic screening tools that we use for things like depression ask about, do you feel joy in your day-to-day? Do you feel like you're a burden on others? Because these are some of the things that folks who are not just socially isolated but really lonely can feel. When folks come into me and I see things like physical changes, changes in weight, changes in nutrition status, changes in physical health, that can indicate to me that people aren't having the support that they need. Sometimes even a disheveled appearance in clinic from someone who may not have looked that way a few months prior. That can show me that things are changing and that we may need to investigate further.
And add to the social connection. My follow-up to that, what types of social connections actually are the ones that are linked to longevity and well-being?
So really, the data is pretty good that any type of connection with others, whether that's friendships, whether it is family, whether it's chosen family, whether it's the relationship between a person and their caregiver, it's not that this needs to be some everlasting thing that's happened since childhood. it's really the idea that as long as folks have the ability to share a part of themselves with others, that's what's tied to better health.
Let's bring in some comments here. Angie says, friends are the lifeline to my life. Thank you for that comment, Angie. Aaliyah says, I have friends who became family because we share a religion and have known each other since we were 6 or 7, grew up in the same Muslim community. These are the people who ask me daily about my father's health, what they can do for my mom. They contribute to my religious and spiritual well-being. Thank you for that comment, Aaliyah. Mary Gross, I want to bring you into the conversation, because if we have established that friendships are beneficial to health, the question is then, how do you make friendships? How do you establish social networks? How have you done that in your life?
Well, I'm very fortunate. My partner and I live at the John C. Anderson Apartments, which is LGBT friendly. So many of us there are, in fact, queer. And we have each other as kindred spirits to a large degree. We are fortunate, Suze and I, of being, I think there are only 2 or 3 couples in the whole building in their 56 apartments. So a lot of people are living alone and isolated. A lot of that is growing up lesbian, gay, queer, trans. In our society, we were very much taboo in our youth. And a lot of the men especially have lost partners over the years because of AIDS, because we were coming of age during, you know, we were in our 30s or whatever in the 80s and 90s. 90s. And it's... several are dealing with HIV and a lot of health problems just from being seniors. We have to be at least 62 to be in the building, and most of us are older than that. And it is a lot of the people are isolated. And when Susan and I got there, we realized that, and we were grateful. William Way and Ed Miller, who works both there and in our building, does a lot to get us together and do like birthday celebrations and so on, and make sure we get social work help, which is also in the building. But Susan and I also started to get to know people and realize there are a lot of like icons in the building. People like Susan Silverman, who recently passed away, who was an original Lavender Menace back in the day.
Activist, and yeah.
Love it.
Yeah. And John James, right a block from here, was marching in 1965 for LGBT rights. And
you formed friendships over these connections?
Yes. Yeah. And what we did, we started a newsletter, Suze and I, and we have about a dozen different people in the building to help us to be writers for it. And it turned out to be even better than we thought it would be. John James did AIDS treatment news for 20 years during AIDS and was a real authority in the whole country on that subject, and was very much able to help us establish a newsletter and what you do to go about that. And I'm the proud editor-in-chief, but it's helped create community in that I put a bio on the front page and of each person in the building who's willing to be interviewed and friends of the building. And it really helped, especially during the pandemic, because people are isolated. And then during the pandemic, they were especially isolated. And I think it's really helped us kind of join forces and know each other better. So,
and I'm going to read another comment before I ask you another question. Mary Ed says, friends have seen his darkest, lowest days while also sharing decades of laughs and memories. Some as long as 45 years are my ride or die. And Jeff says, they have aided in my mental health financially through certain times in my life, and overall just being for me and all the way for me with no ulterior motives and angles. I just want you to talk about the built community, the community that you all built together. How have you seen people change, especially some of the folks who may have been, you know, they're single, they're alone.
Right.
How have you seen things change once this community network started developing?
Oh, that's interesting. And I want to give a big thank you to Mark Siegel, who made this happen. He was his love child to create this building for LGBT seniors. And he really worked hard to actually make it happen. And Micah Majubi and a lot of others helped him in the process. But once we got there, like Susan and I always say, we never really felt comfortable in the communities we lived in until we got to this place where we really feel welcome and really feel included and part of the community. We're not outsiders in any way. And I see people move in there who are very – I remember when Susan and I moved in, we were having financial problems and we were and she had just come through really serious surgery for cancer, and we were really – desperate to be there no matter what we were going to find. But we walked in the door and people said, welcome home. And it just has felt like that ever since. We really feel included. And I see people come in like us who are weathered and tired and really have been through a lot of difficult times. Mm-hmm. And you can see them blossom. And now with the pandemic not as severe, a lot of people gather in the courtyard and just talk and visit every day. And it's just a beautiful thing to see. We've all been through some similar things over our lives. And it's so, so satisfying and so relieving to finally be able to share our stories and our lives with each other. It means a lot to people. You can just see them get healthier by being there.
If you've got thoughts on aging and social networks, give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. Michael, I want to bring you back in the conversation because you mentioned that now you do screening for this. You're asking people about their sense of loneliness and isolation. After you screen, what's the, I guess, prescription? What's the intervention? Because I think it might be hard for people to grasp the idea that a medical provider could help them make friends. Mm.
I completely see it. And I think in medicine, we're really cautious to not screen for things without a way to actually address what we found. That's unfair. It's unethical. So when it comes to screening for loneliness, one of the things that we really have to do, and I think that we do pretty well as healthcare providers, is working with community connections. I mean, some of the things that Mary mentioned earlier are resources and individuals like Ed Miller with the LGBT Elder Initiative for many of my patients. Finding and making ourselves aware of those community groups, those community supports that are available to our patients. In this area, we're fortunate to have a lot, not just for LGBTQIA plus folks, but for older adults in general. We have the Philadelphia Corporation for Aging, which is actively involved in trying to improve programming for folks across identities.
So you might
identities.
Tell a patient, like, hey, this resource exists, that
Correct.
Type of thing?
And
How
even,
do you do that without, I don't know, seeming patronizing? You know, I just feel like it's tough to have that conversation with people sometimes because there's a stigma attached to loneliness and isolation.
There most certainly is. And so the way I try to bring it up to folks is by saying, when I reviewed all of the things that are, say, when I reviewed all the paperwork you filled out when you came in, this stood out to me. Is that something you want to talk about today? Mm. Because the reality is, someone can be lonely, and especially when they're coming to see me for the first time, when they're seeing me with their own kind of list of things that they consider important, that may not be at the top.
Right.
And that is okay. But it's something that we can at least say, okay, we don't have to talk about it today, but we are here to help if you are interested in talking about it or if there's anything you ever want to talk about. And if they open the door, I start by asking what kind of help would you like for this? That's actually one of the things that our standard screening question asks now. It takes away part of that where it says, would you like help with these things?
Yeah.
So if folks are telling us they are interested in help, I think that there are ways to open those conversations, especially in the primary care relationship, without seeming patronizing and without, I do not have any illusions that I'm going to be able to fix someone's loneliness, so to speak, on a first visit or any visit necessarily. But I think the goal is to make people aware of what's out there that may be helpful to them.
Yeah.
So that's my prescription in that case might be, maybe we look into some of these resources. I'm open to making a call to see if this is something that might help.
Oh, that's interesting.
Versus handing something to the patient themselves.
I want to read a comment and shift gears a little bit. Miles comments, we just had a baby and live in Philadelphia, have a strong social network here. While my blood family lives in the Midwest, we decided to stay here because the friends here contribute to our well-being. And I want to ask this question to both of you, and Michael, you first, and then Mary, because friends are different from family and other connections and kids. And I know you and your partner, Mary, have a bunch of grandkids, mm-hmm. a bunch of kids between the two of you. But why are friends, Michael? Why are friends different?
Well, they are and they aren't is the answer that I'll give to that. Because I will say as a gay man who has parents who are lesbians, who I am not biologically related to, their biological families are incredibly important in many situations. Mm-hmm. But in others, we find that these friend networks, especially for folks who have shared experiences, especially for folks who may have had stigmatization or who society may have not treated well, those friends become a certain form of family. I can say that in my own life. I can say that among the patients I treat. So while, yes, there is a difference to some degree, as someone who my biologic family, my chosen family, rather, is many people. Mm. My chosen family is my friends. It is my adoptive parents. It is people in Rhode Island and Philadelphia and all over the country and the world.
So I want to bring in a comment.
It's an interesting concept to get into.
I want to bring in a comment here from Pam. I noticed my mom's friendships have changed over the years. When I was younger, it was a lot about talking about kids and school. But now they talk about their grandchildren, and they also share more details about their lives, even medications they take. I think something about getting older made my mom less private. Does that resonate at all with you, Mary? Do you think that the way you relate to your friends has changed as you've gotten older?
Yes, that's interesting. yeah, well, one thing is, and I don't think you see that as a younger person, getting older's scary. Yeah. You wake up with an ache and pain you never had before. You don't know where it came from, if it's ever going to go away. And so it's really nice to have other people of a similar age to kind of compare notes and recommend doctors, like Dr. Michael here, of course, and just kind of benefit from each other as to, you know, supporting each other, but also, in fact, there are many people in the building who have assigned friends who go with each other to, for instance, colonoscopies. It's really important to have someone with you. And so they are physically supportive, but also just we consider everyone in the building to be family at this point. Mm-hmm. And it is very much a chosen family. And my family was not my kids and grandkids, but my birth family was not supportive. And you need to find people who are supportive in your life. It really matters. Yeah. And you feel better about yourself. And you also have people that you care about that you can confide in and feel comfortable doing that.
We got an email from Jim who says, in-person friendships are better for health than virtual pals. Hmm. Got to ask, does proximity matter? Do you have to see? Because I feel like Mary's really lucky to have her family all around her and this community. But if you don't have that, is it still helpful even if you don't see people every single day? Michael.
I would say virtual is a double-edged sword. Okay. Virtual is an amazing resource for folks who live in remote locations who may not be able to get out of the house. I think what the pandemic showed us, though, is that humans are very social creatures, and virtual only is challenging. Mm. So that's the double-edged part. I think virtual adds a lot to people's lives. But when it's virtual only, it can be really challenging.
Because if you need somebody to take you to the colonoscopy,
exactly.
You need to be in person.
It matters.
Let me bring in one more comment before we have to wrap up. This is from Kate, who says, call the older people in your life and talk about external issues rather than just calling and talking about the weather. So, Michael, let me ask you, we only have about a minute left. If there is someone in my life who I feel like is at risk of being isolated and lonely, what do I do to reach out?
I completely agree with that comment. Call and start a conversation. Talk to them about how things are going in their life. Again, I agree with that, not the weather. Talk about current issues. Get to know them as people. I think in medicine and in the world, we tend to view older folks as older folks, and that's it. And it takes away part of identity there. So really spending time getting to know the people in your life who are important to you, getting to know what's on their mind too. It's not just a cursory check-in call. It should be something where we're actually trying to forge a meaningful bond.
Just be intentional.
Be intentional.
Don't like just that. Pick up the phone. Pick up the phone and really try to connect.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, do you have friends of all ages? How does that impact?
Yes. We've been very fortunate. We've met a lot of people in the LGBT community. of all ages, and we do connect. We have our adopted kids and grandkids that we hang out with and exchange ideas and talk about the changes in the language over the years, and it really means a lot to the in-person. Means everything, actually.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. That's Mary Gross, resident at the John C. Anderson Apartments. Thanks for the time today, Mary.
Thank you.
And we also heard from Dr. Michael Danielewicz, doctor at Jefferson Health, specializing in geriatric medicine. Thanks so much, Michael.
Thank you for having us.
More to come on Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Funded by the Knight Foundation, the Chamber announces its Leading the Way, Cell and Gene Therapy in Greater Philadelphia report. More at chmbr.biz/CGTPHL.
People try to put us to down.
Talking about my generation.
Just because we get around.
Welcome. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I am Avi Wolfman-Arendt, and now we get to hear from some super thoughtful, bright young members of our team here at WHYY. They got together to talk about generational differences. And no, not the ones that typically divide us, but all the good stuff that baby boomers and Gen Xers and millennials have accomplished. They say there's a lot to learn from the folks that grew up before them, and I have to say I agree with that.
Yes, and we featured these Zoomers on the show before. They are Zen, Samaya, and Amelia, who together make up Spoken Youth in partnership with WHYY's Pathways to Media Careers program. They are rejecting the angsty teenager phase, and instead they are focusing on the positive and say it's so worth it for their generation to hurry up and come together.
Hello, this is Spoken Youth. I'm Amelia, and I'm here with Zen and Samaya.
Hello.
Hey.
So one thing I believe from the baby boomer generation that us as youth, we should take with us is their activism spirit. I really admire those who went out there during the civil rights movement and supported in any way they could. And I think that's something that us Gen Z that we embody today with our marches and protests against climate change, for government change, for rights of all different kinds of people. And I think that's something that we should continue because that's something great that came from the baby boomer generation.
I would march with Ban the Bomb marches, and we would all sing, and you know, the bomb never did get banned.
That was my grandmother, who I think is late baby boomer. She's almost 81.
And certainly when all of those women knitted those silly pink hats and did the march after Trump was elected, what was gained thereby, I'm not able to say, except a sense of solidarity that you're not alone.
Mm-hmm. We live in America. One of our constitutional rights is to protest. And I think the baby boomer generation definitely took that and ran with it. From the civil rights movement to the protests against the war in Vietnam, they really used the right to protest, and they took it to a whole nother level to get what they wanted. And there are definitely causes today that could use some of that activism spirit.
Yeah, a lot of good came from it. There's still so many problems that have sprung up that we really need to take to the streets or take to social media or whatever to make some real change. I was also talking about my grandmother, about how she doesn't condemn Gen Z, the young generation, to being lazy.
I don't condemn today's youth as being unaware or lazy or just preoccupied with their own lives.
Yeah, I do really appreciate your grandmother saying that because, like, just the other day I was talking to my mom and she was talking about how all Gen Z is lazy and how we never want to do more than what was given, the tasks we're given.
Mm.
And we do what we're asked and do what we're paid for and never more, nothing less.
Right.
Previous generations, they did, the idea was to do more so that you could get promoted and work up the ladder. I think just Gen Z has a better work-life balance. So I don't think it's an issue of being lazy. I just think it's an issue of knowing self-worth. Mm.
I talked with my dad and I asked him what he thinks was the big events or aspects of their generation of Gen X And the what he said was they were the generation that kind of went, why? Like, why does it have to be this way? Or what if we do it like this? And so they created things like Instagram and Facebook and these things that have evolved over the decades. And now millennials and then Gen Z be developed it into this place for communities, people to get together, for people to communicate, for a place for news to be shared. So I think something we could take away from Gen X is to keep being curious.
So something that millennials started that I think we really need to take in is they start the conversation around mental health.
Mm.
You know, before something happened, it happened. You have to keep going, keep working. Don't talk about it. Just keep at it. But millennials really took this idea of maybe we're not all okay. Maybe we do need to talk about what happened. Maybe we are humans and who express feelings outwards, right?
I'm glad to see that that's what Generation Z is doing right now. That there's a lot of talk about mental health on social media, and there's a lot of different ways, not just on social media, but on the internet in general, in order to find more information about mental health. About it's easier than ever to find professional help.
I think one thing we can do is to continue to push the men in our lives to continue talking about their mental healths. Because you notice a lot of times it's the men who don't want to talk about their feelings because it's considered weak or quote-unquote feminine, right?
But beyond that, also breaking down these gender roles.
Right, yes.
And stop thinking of things at all as very feminine or very masculine.
Yes.
And allowing for a lot of in-between. I really like late 60s, early 70s fashion because it's very androgynous. And there are very similar styles between men's and women's wear. And I think that's a similar thing that we can incorporate today. This blending of all different aspects of fashion that were considered feminine or masculine.
I remember the video for We Are the World, which was all these different musical artists that came together and then they made the song and the music video for it. And I remember just a lot of people saw that when it was happening.
That was my English teacher. I had asked him about a piece of pop culture that really moved his generation, that his entire generation really collectively got behind. And he talked about We Are the World, which is a collection of artists. The only artist I know in that is Michael Jackson. You know, that really got me thinking, because we don't really have a pop culture piece that really brought everybody together, because there's right. so many things that come out at the same time. So we just go from one thing to another, right? Mm-hmm. I think we need to slow down.
Mm.
Gen Z, we like to do things fast-paced. We like to keep things going. But because we do that, sometimes the important things get lost in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes we do things so quickly that something that's really important gets a little bit of screen time or show time because we're right on like that to the next thing.
Right.
When something big hits, take it in and enjoy it.
I hope this generation doesn't become the generation that let the internet and technology and the such fast development of all different kinds of technology lower the quality of our lives. Like, even though we are young, you know, we're only hitting our 20s, we need to figure out how to band together and start making solutions to problems, because those problems are getting worse and they're getting to a point where it can turn very disastrous for society as a whole.
I think the most important thing going forward is that Gen Z and Gen Alpha take the good and trim the fat. This was Spoken Youth.
I'm Amelia.
I'm Zamaya.
And I'm Zen.
I want to sort of break out in song.
Go ahead.
Right here, but I will.
I won't stop you.
I will spare our listeners. But this was such a thoughtful conversation.
It was.
And these young people are like the perfect combination of all the best of previous generations. I love it.
But they don't know anyone in We Are the World.
No, they
don't.
Was
that not shocking to you besides Michael Jackson?
Well, no, it's not shocking because I'm actually the Zoomers. I've been saying
Stevie
Zoomers a
Wonder,
lot.
Stevie Wonder, Lionel Richie, Bruce Springsteen.
I know.
It's okay. When next time they're in the building, we'll school them.
We'll school them.
We'll play some records for them.
And they're open to it.
And
they're open to it. So.
That brings us to the end of today's episode of Studio 2. We are not the world, but we are Studio 2. And our show is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Adam Staniszewski is our engineer. You can head to whyy.org/studio2 for more and download the program wherever you get your podcasts. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. And if you get the podcast, don't forget to rate and review.